You know, when I was a student in university at the University of Guelph, one of the websites that I often kept an eye on was a website called ratemyprofessors.com. And if you're a college or university student, and I think they might even have a high school version of this, probably you high school teachers cringe when you look at that website. And I was thinking this week, I'm thankful they haven't made a pastor's version of it yet. Hopefully this doesn't inspire anybody. But it was a website as a student, I kept my eye on it. And just out of curiosity, I looked it up again this week and confirmed this website is indeed still in operation. And so ratemyprofessor.com, this is a website where college and university students leave reviews for their profs, and you can rank your professors in a number of different categories. And so you go on this website, you can generally find out whether the prof is well-liked by the students or whether they're not all that well-liked. You can find out whether their lectures are engaging and interesting or whether they are boring and tedious. You can find out whether they're hard markers, whether taking their class is going to boost or batter your GPA, and whether they are friendly, whether they're approachable, or whether they are aloof. And as a university student, I want to maximize my learning experience. I want to get the best bang for my buck. And so I'd hop on that website at the beginning of the semester as I was making course selections. I wanted to get the best profs at my university. I want to dodge the notorious ones, and I wanted to brace myself for the ones that I couldn't avoid. And occasionally I would even leave my own reviews, respectful reviews, which not all of them are when you go on. But you know, I haven't thought about that website in years, but this past week as I was preparing for the sermon this morning and considering the Book of Kings, it kind of struck me, the Book of Kings is a bit like an inspired version of Rate My Professor, or we could say Rate My King, or My Prime Minister, or whatever. It's a bit like an inspired version of that website, because here in the chapters, we find very honest and sometimes very blunt evaluations from the Holy Spirit on how these men did in their role, how well they fulfilled their God-given duties. And so we're going to open our Bibles once again this morning. We're going to turn to the Book of Kings again. We're going to have a look at the biblical version of ratemyprofessors.com. And this morning we're looking at three reviews of three different leaders in Israel, and they happen to be a father, a son, and a grandson. A father, a son, a grandson, they served one after another as kings in Judah. And so let's open God's Word, 1 Kings chapter 14. 1 Kings 14, we're going to pick up the reading in verse 21, and we're going to continue all the way down to chapter 15, verse 24. 14:21 to 15:24. And I remind you as I read, this is God's inspired and inerrant word. Chapter 14, verse 21. Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite. And Judah did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They provoked him to jealousy with their sins that they committed, more than all that their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places and pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. In the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away the shields of gold that Solomon had made, and King Rehoboam made in their place shields of bronze, committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house. And as often as the king went into the house of the Lord, the guard carried them and brought them back to the guard room. Now, the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continually. And Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite, and Abijam his son reigned in his place. Now in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, son of Nebat, Abijam began to reign over Judah. He reigned for 3 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom. And he walked in all the sins that his father did before him, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father. Nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, setting up his son after him, and establishing Jerusalem, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and did not turn aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Now there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the days of his life. The rest of the acts of Abijam and all he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And there was war between Abijam and Jeroboam. And Abijah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And Asa his son reigned in his place. In the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa began to reign over Judah. And he reigned 41 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom. And Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David his father had done. He put away the male cult prostitutes out of the land, and he removed all the idols that his father had made. He also removed Maacah, his mother, from being the queen mother, because she made an abominable image for Asherah. And Asa cut down her image and burned it at the brook Kidron. But the high places were not taken away. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true to the Lord all his days. And he brought into the house of the Lord the sacred gifts of his father and his own sacred gifts, silver and gold and vessels. And there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. Baasha, king of Israel, went up against Judah and built Ramah, that he might permit no one to go out or to come in to Asa, the king of Judah. Then Asa took all the silver and the gold that were left in the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and gave them to the hands of his servants. And King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon, the son of Hezion, king of Syria, who lived in Damascus, saying, "Let there be a covenant between me and you as there was between my father and your father. Behold, I'm sending you a present of silver and gold. Go and break your covenant with Baasha, king of Israel, that he may withdraw from me." And Ben-Hadad listened to King Asa and sent the commanders of his armies against the cities of Israel and conquered Ijon, Dan, Abel, Beth-Maacah, all Chinneroth, and the land of Naphtali. And when Baasha heard of it, he stopped building Ramah, and he lived in Tirzah. Then King Asa made a proclamation to all Judah. None was exempt. And they carried away the stones of Ramah and its timber, with which Baasha had been building, and with them King Asa built Geba of Benjamin and Mizpah. Now the rest of the acts of Asa, all his might and all he did, and the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? But in his old age he was diseased in his feet. And Asa slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David his father. And Jehoshaphat his son reigned in his place. This is the word of the Lord. Well, churches, we turn our attention this morning back to the kingdom of Judah, the southern portion of the kingdom, as we consider the reigns of three generations of kings. We're going to see this morning, with God's help, three kinds of rulers that God had placed in authority over Israel. First of all, a retreating king named Rehoboam. Secondly, a reprobate king named Abijam. And then thirdly and finally, a reforming king named Asa. We have a retreating king, we have a reprobate king, and we have a reforming king, and that's where we're heading today with the help of our God. And so let's look first of all at this depressing story of retreat. A retreating king, King Rehoboam, who at the very best receives a frigid, lackluster review. We find the abysmal description of Rehoboam's reign in the concluding 10 verses of chapter 14. We can also find an account of his reign in the parallel section. This is the book of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapters 11 and 12. By the way, I haven't mentioned this very much up to this point in our sermon series, but the book of Chronicles is in many ways a parallel companion to the book of Kings. And most of you probably know this already, that in the chronological ordering of the English Bibles, we find these books close together. In the Old Testament, there's the book of 1 and 2 Kings, originally one book that was broken in two because of the scrolls, and then 1 and 2 Chronicles. These are located back to back. But you may be interested, in the Hebrew ordering of the Old Testament, Kings and Chronicles are actually found in two different sections of the Hebrew Bible. The English Bible, the canonical order of the books in the English Old Testament, they follow the order of the Greek versions, the Greek Septuagint. And our English Bibles put the Old Testament books in chronological order. They're listed in historical order. But if you look at the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish Bible has the same books, but they're placed in a different order. In the Hebrew ordering of the Bible, the book of Kings is in a different section. There's three sections in the Hebrew Bible. There's the law, or the Torah, there's the prophets, and then there's the writings. The law, the prophets, and the writings. And the book of Kings is found in the prophets. Well, the book of Chronicles is part of the writings. In fact, if you look at a Hebrew Bible, at a Jewish Bible, do you know what the last book of the Old Testament is? It's not Malachi in the Hebrew Bible. It's actually 2 Chronicles, where it speaks about the end of the exile. And so Chronicles ends with the people going up out of exile. That's the last book in the Hebrew Bible. And as we make our way through the remainder of Kings in the sermon series, I'm going to be making more reference to the material in Chronicles, because that book, it helps to nuance, it helps to fill out the biblical picture painted for us in these chapters. And in a sense, it's a bit like looking at multiple reviews on Rate My Professors. These are two different reviews. They don't contradict one another. They complement one another. They help us as the reader round out to better grasp the overarching picture of that particular king or leader. But for our purposes this morning, the rest of the series in Kings, be aware, the book of Kings was written a number of years before the book of Chronicles, and that these books were written for two different purposes. By the way, you may notice that it keeps saying at the end of the Kings, if you want to know more information about this king, look at the book of the Chronicles. And you say, well, what book is that? That must be the biblical book of Chronicles. Actually not. We're not sure what that book is that they're referring to. That's a lost book that was also called Chronicles, that was written before the book of Kings. But the book of Chronicles that we find in our Bibles was actually written after the book of Kings for a different reason. The book of Kings, as I mentioned before, it was written during the time of the exile. And the book of Kings was written in order to help the Jewish exiles understand the reasons for God's judgment upon their nation. That the Babylonian exile came about as a result of covenant breaking. The primary responsibility for the exile and for Israel's failure lies at the feet of her rulers, her disobedient kings. And theologians and philosophers refer to this kind of literature as a theodicy. A theodicy, that's a word that means a type of writing that helps us wrap our minds around the reasons for evil and suffering that we experience in the world. And in exile, the Jews were saying, why is God allowing this to happen? And the book of Kings is the answer. It was a result of covenant breaking. And so Kings was written as a theodicy for God's people living in exile, providing an explanation for their sufferings in Babylon. The book of Chronicles, 1 and 2 Chronicles, was written sometime later. It was written after the Jews returned from Babylon, and this second account of Israel's kings was intended to inspire the people to obedience back in the land. And this is one of the nuances between the two books, that while the book of Kings tends to highlight the sins and the failures of Israel's kings as a way of explaining the exile, the book of Chronicles, you'll notice, takes a more positive tone. When you compare the two, you often get a more positive image of the king in the book of Chronicles. That is, by design, because the author there wants to tell us some of the things that the kings did right. Just because the kings were evil doesn't mean they didn't do anything right. And so we're getting a fuller picture when we read these books together. So just know that they were written at different times in history for different literary reasons. The book of Kings is more harsh in its evaluation. The book of Chronicles tends to be more positive, and it highlights some of the things that the kings did right. And so I want to encourage you from this point on in the series, as you prepare to hear the sermon, don't just read the material in Kings, but flip over to Chronicles and read the material in Chronicles as you prepare to come for the preaching of the word. But back in our text here in 1 Kings 14, you know this, if you've been following this series, this is not the first time that we've met King Rehoboam. Rehoboam was introduced to us back in chapter 12. He was the son of Solomon. He was the successor of Solomon. And as we learned a number of weeks ago, it was Rehoboam's harshness, it was Rehoboam's big ego that pushed the northern tribes into the arms of this man named Jeroboam, and that led to the division of the nation. Instead of patiently listening to the grievances of the northern tribes, what does Rehoboam do? He tries to intimidate them. He tries to throw his weight around. He tries to bully them, and in doing so, he lost the respect of the people. He lost the consent to govern. Of course, we know there were human errors or human factors leading to the division of Israel. We also know all of these things were taking place under the sovereign watch of the Lord, His meticulous sovereignty. That already, and we know this in the text, that before Rehoboam, before Jeroboam, during the time of Solomon, God had already decided to divide the nation and to give 10 of the tribes to this rival king named Jeroboam. Now, the initial impression of Rehoboam that we glean in chapter 12 is not all that impressive. It doesn't exactly fill our hearts with a warm, fuzzy feeling. The impression we get in chapter 12 is a foolish, petulant young man. As my grandpa would say, a man who is too big for his own britches, right? And now in chapter 14, having informed us of the dumpster fire in northern Israel, we now turn to the south. Surely things must be going better in the south. And so chapter 14, we switch focus to the southern kingdom of Judah, and we're told that Rehoboam began to reign when he was 41 years old. And that Rehoboam reigns in the southern kingdom for 17 years. This is a slightly shorter reign than his counterpart Jeroboam in the north. Over in Chronicles, the 11th chapter, in the parallel section, we're told by the author that immediately after the division of the two kingdoms, there was a massive influx of Levitical priests into Judah. That all of these religious clerical refugees who wanted no part in Jeroboam's false religion relocated themselves and their families to the south. And they saw the writing on the wall. They wanted to live in the vicinity of the temple in Jerusalem. And in Chronicles, we're informed that these faithful clergymen, these Levites from the northern tribes, he says that they strengthened the kingdom of Judah, and for 3 years they made Rehoboam secure, because they walked for 3 years in the way of David and Solomon. And so in the earliest part of Rehoboam's reign, it was the faithful clergy who helped to stave off the effects of spiritual decay upon the nation. That the pastors, in this case the Levites, the priests, had a role to play in the preservation of the kingdom. But the reprieve from idolatry was short-lived. Faithfulness of these northern clergymen did not cause Rehoboam to repent. He did not follow the Lord. He did not turn from his evil ways. In spite of the fact that God had chosen Jerusalem, he had specifically set his name there and his presence, the token of his presence in the temple. Verse 22, it says that Judah did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They provoked him to jealousy with their sins that they committed more than all their fathers had done, for they built for themselves high places and pillars and Asherim on every high hill and under every green tree, and there were male cult prostitutes in the land. And they did according to all the abominations of the nations that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. You know, for all of Rehoboam's faults and flaws in leading the people astray, it's important to notice here that part of the burden of guilt, part of the responsibility, lies on the people themselves. It's not only the kings that are to blame. It's the people who, along with this foolish king, break covenant to the Lord, and they continue in the same idolatry that Solomon instituted. So Rehoboam isn't the only one who bears responsibility. The people embrace these reprehensible forms of idolatry, the depraved worship of these Canaanite fertility gods. This is demon worship. Same as every false worship is the worship of demons, the doctrines of demons. And you know the way that the worship is described here? It's meant to provoke your astonishment. It's meant to disgust you. You read this about under every tree and high hill, idolatrous shrines, there's male cult prostitutes. President Biden this past week just passed the day of trans visibility, used his presidential platform to proclaim this wickedness. Well, guess what, brothers and sisters? There's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing new under the sun. Only here, it's not meant to provoke admiration. It's meant to provoke disgust. It's disgusting. God's people are now indistinguishable from the Canaanites. That's the point. These are God's people. Chosen, elect, meant to be different. God's treasured possession, the redeemed from the nations, a light to the Gentiles. And they live just like the Canaanites. They're just as bad as the ones that God vomited out of the land. And the worst forms of Canaanite religion are being practiced in the very place where God sets his name and his glory. We're not going to go into all the gritty details of this religion this morning because it truly is disgusting. It's truly revolting. And the depravity of this religion would make you sick to your stomach. Or at least it ought to. We read here about the moral decay in Judah. This resurgence of paganism and Canaanite religion in Israel. And it's helpful to remember, I think, that all of these things are happening within one generation of David's death. Have you ever considered that? All of this is happening within one generation of David's death. You may assume as the reader that hundreds of years have passed. No, not so. Only about 40 years. And some of the people who are alive at this time were alive when David was reigning. They were alive at that time. And they were there when Solomon dedicated the temple. Brethren, it only takes one weak link to ruin a chain. You're going to have a strong chain. It only takes one weak link to make your chain useless. It only takes one unfaithful generation to ruin a nation, to plunge a nation into spiritual calamity. Open your eyes and look what's happening right here in Canada. I mean, just think about it. All of us in this room can testify to it, the immense cultural change that we've witnessed over the course of our lives. I'm 40 years old, the same age as Rehoboam when he started to reign. Okay, a relatively young man. And I think back to my childhood, the late 1980s and the 1990s, and I look at the challenges that my children, and that children in general, that some of your grandchildren are facing today, it is almost astonishing. It's astonishing the speed with which it's taken place. Some of you went to public school. I went to public school all through. I went to high school at E.L. Crossley. When I was in public school, homosexuality was not something you advertised. It was not a badge of honor. when I was in public school, if a male student ever tried to walk into the girls' bathroom, it wouldn't be good. You know, that was a cardinal sin of public school. Guys don't go in the girls' bathroom. Girls don't go in the guys' bathroom. You do that, you go to the principal's office, get a detention at best, or a suspension. And today, if you resist it, as Josh Alexander is doing, he's been expelled from his school. Who would have dreamed in the 1980s and 90s that gay marriage and transgenderism would be totally normalized within our lifetime here in the West? Did you ever dream that the definition of marriage would be changed? Did you ever dream that the definition of gender would be changed, that people wouldn't know that there's male and female? Did you ever dream that the English language would be revised in order to accommodate for all of these new pronouns and this gender ideology? Did you ever dream that in a free nation like Canada, that free speech would give way to compelled speech? That if you refuse to use these lying genders that don't exist, that you can be criminally charged and held, brought to a hate speech tribunal and fired from your job? Did you ever dream that Canadian citizens would not only be expected to extend tolerance in a liberal democracy, but actually to embrace these developments and to celebrate them? And if you don't do so, to be canceled, to be labeled as a bigot? I tip my hat to the NHL players that have been in the news over these past couple years who have a spine to stand up against this nonsense. Who would have dreamed 30 years ago we would live in a nation where one of the leading causes of death among Canadian citizens is state-sponsored suicide? And that's what it is. State-sponsored murder. 1 in 30 citizens, 1 in 30 Canadians who are now killed by medical doctors on the payroll of the state. It's a cult of death. When I was a kid, I remember Saturday mornings watching cartoons, and you remember the commercials that showed you what your brain would look like if you took drugs. You know, try hugs, not drugs. And now we are 20, 30 years later, you can't walk 2 blocks in a Canadian city without passing a cannabis store. And the government used to warn us to stay away from drug dealers. Now they are the drug dealer. This is Canada. This is Canada. Brethren, all it takes for a nation like Canada to plunge headfirst into utter chaos, depravity, and ruin is one generation. One generation. And sadly, many of the things that we are witnessing in our culture today, they are taking place because a former generation turned a blind eye to these things and allowed the moral revolution to steam ahead. I've only been on this planet for 40 years, and the world that my children and your grandchildren are growing up in is a different world than the one that I knew. This is not the same country. This is not the same culture. King Rehoboam could have turned it around before it got to this point, but he didn't really care. An open-minded, tolerant, progressive man. In fact, 2 Chronicles 12, verse 1 says that when the rule of Rehoboam was established, and when he became strong, he abandoned the law of the Lord and all Israel with him. Faithful follower of God as long until he gets established, and then I don't need God anymore. Who needs God? For the first 3 years of his reign, the priests keep the nation moving forward in the right direction. Eventually, even the clergy can't stem the tide of the wickedness as the king abandons the Lord and his law. And we've read about the northern kingdom, and we've hoped for better things in the southern kingdom of Judah. By the time we are 3 years into the reign of Rehoboam, the compromise in the south is just as bad as the compromise in the north. And judging by the description, maybe it's even worse. And as a result of this appalling disobedience and compromise, we read in verse 25, God's discipline begins to fall on these people. Verse 25, in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away all the shields of gold that Solomon had made, and King Rehoboam made in their place shields of bronze and committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house. And as often as the king went into the house of the Lord, the guard carried them and brought them back to the guard room. Once every year, the Israelites celebrate the Passover feast, which they will be doing very soon, this week, commemorating the miraculous way that Yahweh delivered their nation from the Egyptians and defeated the Egyptians and drowned the Pharaoh and his army in the Red Sea. And here we are, King Rehoboam, a submissive vassal to the Egyptian Pharaoh. This is the same nation. Pharaoh once being drowned in the sea and his armies, and now he waltzes into the palace and the temple. He does whatever he wants. Nobody will stop him. And the Israelites are now slaves. They've come full circle. They're slaves, vassals. As an aside here, you may be interested to know the Pharaoh who is mentioned as Shishak in this chapter, this Pharaoh has been attested by modern archaeologists. In Egyptian hieroglyphics, his name is written and pronounced as Shoshank, which sounds a lot like Shishak. Shoshank, the founder of the 22nd dynasty, and Shoshank's aggressive military campaigns to the land of Israel are well documented by the Egyptian hieroglyphics. And they've been discovered, the record of this from the Egyptian perspective is inscribed in stone on the monuments at Karnak in Egypt. Shishak was proud of his dominance over Israel. He wanted Israel's humiliation to be remembered. And so the mention of Pharaoh Shishak, his aggression against southern Israel, this is one of many, many examples from the realm of archaeology that validates and confirms the things that we read in the Bible. Although Pharaoh Shishak didn't destroy Jerusalem at this time, he didn't remove Rehoboam from his throne. We read in these verses, the Egyptians plundered the wealth of Solomon, and they bring all the gold back to Egypt. Do you remember the description after the Exodus, what happened? Israel plundered the Egyptians. They took all the gold out of Egypt, and now all the gold is going back. The Egyptians are plundering the Israelites. Under Solomon's leadership, Israel reaches the golden age, so to speak. This is the peak, the pinnacle of their influence in the ancient world. Now under Solomon's foolish son, the golden age is downgraded. And now we're in the Bronze Age. Pharaoh takes all Solomon's gold shields. And this is pretty pathetic. In spite of all of the problems, Rehoboam wants to pretend that everything's fine. You know, the gold shields are gone. What should we do now? Well, let's make some bronze one. And we can parade around with them and pretend that everything's okay. Just the same as it always was. The nation is in moral freefall. The king is on the run. The blessing of God has been removed from this nation. But the show must go on. The charade must go on. And so that, my friends, is a sorry story of King Rehoboam, the retreating king who lost his grip but still pretends that everything's fine. Verse 30, we read that there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continually, and Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. It's interesting, it mentions twice at the beginning, at the end, reminding us who his mother was, Naamah the Ammonite. Naamah the Ammonite, a reminder of Solomon's disobedience. Disobedience has consequences. King Rehoboam, we see the description of a retreating king, a kingdom in moral and spiritual freefall, yet a king going through the outward motions, pretending that everything is just fine. Well, let's see how king number two fares. Second king reviewed in the text, this is the son of Rehoboam. His name is Abijam. Abijam, meaning, by the way, the son of Yam, Yam being the Canaanite god of the sea. That tells you something. We learn about this second king, the first 10 verses of chapter 15. The first thing you'll notice about King Abijam is that his reign is considerably shorter than any of the kings who come before. David and Solomon, they both reigned for a full generation. 40 years is a full generation. Well, Rehoboam reigns for 17 years. That's a half generation. Now we see Rehoboam's son Abijam reigning for a mere 3 years in the land of Judah. This is the shortest tenure that we've seen to date. And I believe it is a clue in the text that this man has lost the blessing of God. The favor of God does not rest upon him. Although Abijam is a reprobate king who continues in the same sins as his father Rehoboam, he does nothing to challenge the idolatry of his nation. We read here that God graciously preserves his dynasty for the sake of David. I think it's a bit revealing here in a section of text dedicated to this man, Abijam. Who does the author spend his time talking about? You read through these verses and there's way more information here about David than there is about Abijam. This contrast between David's righteousness and Abijam's wickedness. And really Abijam's main claim to fame is that he's not like David. He doesn't measure up. He's a wicked man. And the only reason why God allows his dynasty to continue is because of the Davidic covenant. God had made unconditional promises to David years earlier. God would establish his dynasty forever. And so here in the book of Kings, a small amount of space devoted to Abijam corresponds to his spiritual stature. This is a king who does not measure up. This is a king who falls far short of David's righteousness. This is not a king after God's own heart. This is a reprobate king. Now, the book of Chronicles, if you read the parallel section, also speaks about King Abijam and presents him in a slightly better light. 2 Chronicles 13, we learn Abijam fought against Jeroboam. He won a major battle in which he and the people of Judah were outnumbered 2-1. And what's interesting about Abijam is that he often talks a good talk. In Chronicles, this becomes evident. He talks as though he's a true follower of God. He taunts his enemies with the covenant that God had made with Judah. As he prepares for war against Jeroboam, he speaks very piously against Jeroboam's golden calves, and he mentions the fact that Judah is home to legitimate priests. Judah is home to a temple, and all this time they're worshiping the Canaanite gods under every high tree, and there's male cult prostitution in the land. And he appeals to the Davidic dynasty, and he shows an awareness of the covenantal promises that God had made. Abijam maintains an outward form of righteousness, an outward form of speech and decorum, but inwardly he is dead, morally depraved. He's a lot like the Pharisees in the New Testament, who Jesus castigates and tells them, "You guys are like whitewashed tombs. You talk a good talk. On the outside, you look pretty good, but you are putrid. You are putrid within. You are dead." And as we read about this king named Abijam, we compare the book of Kings with Chronicles, I'm reminded about the kind of rhetoric we often hear today from our own godless, immoral politicians. These reprobate men and women sold out to moral depravity. They actively perpetuate policies that ruin our nation, that go against God's word and God's law, but yet they sometimes speak in public as though they are Christians and invoke the name of our God and use Christian and religious jargon when it suits their own political ambition. That's the kind of man that Abijam was. No different. He's a spiritual reprobate who knows how to talk a good game. He may have even fooled some of the people. They said, "Look at how this man talks. Look at how this man knows his biblical words. He must be just like David." But God's not fooled. And God brings his evil regime to an end in 3 years. Well, so far we see a retreating king, a reprobate king. Thirdly, finally, the review of a reforming king, King Asa, who reigns in Judah for 41 years. This is another full generation. Who helps to clean up the mess that his father and his grandfather leave behind. Unlike his grandpa Rehoboam, who embraced a policy of retreat, unlike his dad Abijam, whose walk doesn't match his talk, Asa, for the most part, is a good and godly leader. He is actually one of the better kings. He's one of the better kings to come after David. And verse 1 gives us an encouraging summary of the man's leadership. It says in verse 11, Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David his father had done. And he put away the male cult prostitutes from the land. He removed all the idols his father had made. He also removed Maacah, his mother, from being queen mother, because she had made an abominable image for Asherah. And Asa cut down her image and burned it at the brook Kidron. This man Asa, in the early part of his reign, he shows a zeal for the Lord that has not been seen in Israel since the time of David. This is a genuine zeal for the Lord. And instead of turning a blind eye to the Canaanite idolatry and the abominations being practiced within the borders, Asa outlaws it. He says, these things ought not to be practiced in this nation. And he outlaws it, and he cleanses the nation of its idolatry and its sexual depravity. And Asa is the real deal. You say, maybe this guy's like his dad. Maybe he's just putting on a religious show. Well, we know that's not the case, because Asa brings the Reformation home. This is the amazing thing about King Asa. Reformation begins in his own household. All of the idols that dear old dad set up are removed. All of them. And we're told he even stripped the queen mother of her royal privilege because of her unrepentant participation in this fertility cult. You know, as I studied the text this week, and if you read the text carefully and you look at the details of Asa's family tree, there's a difficult thing that comes up here. And we were together with the elders last night, and this came up. Question, who is Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom? Because if you read carefully, you look up the page to verse 2, what do you notice? You notice that this woman, Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom, is identified as the mother of Abijam. Okay, fair enough. Well, look down the page to verse 10. Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom, is also identified as the mother of Asa. That raises a question, doesn't it? It's hard to even speak about this possibility, but at least one of the commentaries I consulted in my study this week took the position that King Asa was the product of an incestuous relationship, that his mother Maacah was also his father's mother. It is hard to imagine such a wicked thing taking place. It's hard to imagine. But once you start down the road of sexual revolution, there are no limits. The most disgusting things take place. And so, given the state of Israel at this time, it is not outside the realm of possibility. But there's a second explanation, which I think is more likely, and that is that Maacah was Asa's biological grandmother. Because in Hebrew, the word mother can be used in a broader sense to mean either mother or possibly even grandmother. So it's quite possible that Asa's mother died, that his grandmother Maacah helped to raise him as a young child, and that she held this high-ranking position as the queen mother. But whichever of these two possibilities is actually the case, whether Asa is the product of incest or whether Maacah is his grandmother, we see here in this man a man who is not afraid to hold his family members to account. Not even grandma gets a free pass. Not even grandma does as she pleases. And I think that speaks volumes about the man. After 40 years of spiritual decline in Israel, God raises up a reformer. And here's a king who's walking in the footsteps of David. It kind of makes you wonder, what happened? What happened to this guy? Why did he suddenly change direction? Why did he break course with his family? Well, the answer is God's sovereignty. God's sovereign grace and mercy, who can regenerate the heart of anyone. And although some of the remnants of idolatry do remain in the land, and not all the high places are removed as we would hope, verse 14, it says that the heart of Asa was wholly true to the Lord all his days. In other words, King Asa is the real McCoy. He is a genuine believer. He is working hard for reformation. But as we all know, in our own lives, in our own experience, genuine believers, we are all men and women with clay feet. And Asa was no exception. He was a good man. He was a courageous man in many ways, but he wasn't a perfect man. And sadly, it seems that as Asa grew older, as death came nearer, his reforming zeal began to cool. And his trust in the Lord began to waver. Once again here, in evaluating the quality of Asa's leadership, you look at the parallel section, 2 Chronicles 14 and 15. And in 2 Chronicles 14, we're informed of a battle that took place during the earlier part of Asa's reign. It says that the Ethiopian king came against him with a vast army. It says there was 1 million men. Can you imagine an army of 1 million men coming against you? And it says there were many chariots. They had good technology. And it was terrifying. It looked to Judah, how are we going to win this? Victory looks impossible. And we're told that Asa, in this time of national crisis, turns to the Lord and he leads the people in prayer, just as Solomon had done. 2 Chronicles 14:11, it says that Asa cried to the Lord his God, O Lord, there is none like you to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on you, and in your name we have come against this multitude. O Lord, you are our God. Let not man prevail against you. The text in Chronicles doesn't give us details about the battle itself. We're told that in response to Asa's prayer, the Lord defeated the Ethiopians and they fled. This 1 million-man army. Insurmountable odds. The Lord gives victory to King Asa. He shows the people of Judah they can trust him to fight their battles. They can trust him. He's the same God that fought for Israel during the time of Joshua and during the time of Moses and during the time of David. And this mighty defeat of the Ethiopians, this is what ushers in this period of reformation. The people of Judah gather together. They offer sacrifice to the one true God. They renew their covenant with God. 2 Chronicles 15:11, it says, they sacrificed to the Lord. On that day from the spoil, they brought 700 oxen, 7,000 sheep. And they entered into a covenant to seek the Lord, the God of their fathers, with all their heart and all their soul. And whoever would not seek the Lord, the God of Israel, should be put to death, whether young or old man or woman. And they swore an oath to the Lord with a loud voice and with shouting and trumpets and horns. And Israel rejoiced over the oath, for they had sworn it with all their hearts, and they sought him with their whole desire, and he was found by them. And the Lord gave them rest all around. For 36 years, he reigned for 41 years. For 36 years, the vast majority of his reign as king, we are told in Chronicles, Asa followed God. For 36 years, with his whole heart, and a reformation took root in the land and it bore fruit, the nation of Judah turned back to the Lord and they forsook their evil ways. But sadly, the final few years of Asa's life, the reforming king begins to stumble. He is, in some senses, a bit like Solomon, a man who started off so well, but who stumbles across the finish line. 1 Kings 15, 2 Chronicles 16, there we learn about a second battle that took place at the end of his reign. In fact, in the 36th year of his reign, at this point in time, Asa is at war with the northern tribes of Israel. He is fighting against this king named Baasha, who is one of Jeroboam's successors. And Baasha hates the southern kingdom. He hates the work that God is doing in the southern kingdom, and he wants to destroy it. And so he fortifies a city called Ramah, which is right on the border. It's just like 5 miles north of Jerusalem, right on the border. And Baasha takes these provocative steps. He blocks the main highway leading between the north and the south. He establishes a trade embargo that would decimate Judah's economy and cut off one of their main avenues of travel and trade. It's kind of like, I think it was in the 60s when Egypt cut off access to the Suez Canal for Israel, and it resulted in war. That's what he was trying to do. And understandably, Baasha's aggression catches the attention of Asa, who starts to worry about this. He's saying, what do I do to fix this? Now, it's not the first time that he's been here. In fact, the last time there was a million men up against him, and he trusted in God. But now at the end of his life, in the twilight of his reign, Asa decides that he's going to play politics. And so instead of going to the Lord with this problem, he goes instead to the king of Damascus. This is not a believer. This is a pagan king. This is an enemy of Israel, and he's in a formal alliance with the northern king of Israel. And Asa approaches this enemy in the north, and he pays him a bribe to break off his treaty with Baasha and realign his loyalties with Judah. And how did he pay for this? Where did he get the money? He took it out of the temple treasury. He robs the Lord to pay off the king of Syria. Instead of trusting in God to fight his battles, as he did when he was a young man, the old man decides to play politics. He decides to bribe and to pay and to purchase a victory with God's money. And you know, if we look at this matter from a purely human political point of view, we may conclude that Asa was a pretty smart guy. This is a pretty brilliant diplomatic move. In one sense, the plan was a resounding success. Verse 20 to 22 tells us his new alliance with Syria caused Baasha to abandon the campaign. He removed the blockade, and he went to deal with the new threat on the northern border. And on top of that, an extra benefit, all the building materials that Baasha had left unattended 5 miles north of Jerusalem, well, Asa sends some of his men, they take all of that material, and they build their own fortifications. Nice bonus. And so Asa's plan accomplished its goal. Very likely the elimination of the threat boosted his popularity. If you did a poll, I imagine there would have been a spike in his approval ratings at this point. But we turn to 2 Chronicles 16. We discover what God thought about Asa's diplomacy. In 2 Chronicles 16, verse 7, it says that at that time, Hanani the prophet came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you relied on the king of Syria and did not rely on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Syria has escaped you. Were not the Ethiopians and the Libyans a huge army with many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he gave them into your hand. And here's a verse that many of you will recognize. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless towards him. That verse was given in the context of a rebuke to King Asa. The prophet says, you've done foolishly in this thing. From now on, you will have war. Asa's political expediency won a short-term reprieve from the crisis. But God's prophet informs him, you've done an extremely stupid thing. Asa, you have traded a short-term gain for long-term pain. If Asa had trusted in God, if he had acted in faith like he did against the Ethiopians, he would have triumphed over both of his enemies, over Baasha and Ben-Hadad. Instead, he empties the temple treasury for a bribe, and in so doing, he makes himself a subordinate to the king of Syria. This is the activity, this is the behavior of a subordinate paying off a superior. And so while Asa was likely receiving all kinds of backslaps from his friends, the prophet Hanani is the only man in Israel with enough courage to tell him the truth. And while we may have hoped that this prophetic rebuke would humble Asa and cause him to repent, we learn instead, 2 Chronicles 16, Asa was angry with the prophet. And he put him in the stocks and in prison. for he was in a rage with him because of this. And Asa inflicted cruelties upon some of the people at that time. By the time we reach the concluding years of his reign in Judah, Asa has abandoned the reforming zeal of his youth. And sadly, he has become something of a persecuting tyrant. He's no longer listening to the Lord. He's no longer looking to God for help. And the final snapshot we have of King Asa is that of a stubborn, self-sufficient old man. He's an old man. He has a disease in his feet. Most likely this is a case of gangrene. And it's probably the disease that ended up killing him. But he will not go to God for help. And instead of turning to the Lord in his time of illness, what does he do? He goes instead to the doctors. Not that there's anything wrong with doctors. We thank God for doctors. But we know that the Lord is the great physician. He's the one that heals. Sometimes he heals through doctors. But Asa wasn't going to the Lord. He was putting his trust in these men who couldn't cure his illness. And it was shortly after this final failure of faith that Asa dies. He starts so well in the work of reformation, but he flounders at the end. By the way, this is a recurring theme in the book of Kings. This is a warning for all of us. Keep running. Keep running the race. Don't give up. Finish strong. And I'm going to impress this. I've done it once already. I'm going to keep doing this. In particular, senior citizens, this is for you. In particular. Those of you who are in your senior years and you've run well, you've been faithful, and the finish line is approaching, it is not the time to coast. It is not the time to compromise. It is not the time to say, I've worked hard and now I should be comfortable. And you lay aside your convictions for the sake of comfort in your latter years. Now is the time, senior citizens, set an example for those who are young. Show us what it looks like to finish well. We're watching you. We're looking to you. When we compare Asa with the other kings that came before him, we easily agree with the inspired author. Asa is a good king. He's a breath of fresh air. Even so, the Bible is not shy in telling us about Asa's flaws and the fact that he started better than he finished. Asa's work comes as a real encouragement to the reader. It reminds us, it reminded me this week, it is indeed possible for God in his mercy and kindness to turn wicked nations around. I was encouraged by this week. Here in our own nation of Canada and much of the Western world, we are now faced with a season of rampant wickedness. And it really does seem that our leaders descend to new depths of depravity each and every week. You think, how low can it go? How evil can these people get? And then you turn on the news and you say, well, it got more evil this week. This week, if you watch the news, Joe Biden declares a day of visibility for transgender in the wake of a hate crime perpetuated by the transgender community towards Christians. And not only that, our own prime minister pushes through a censorship bill this week in Canada and the United States. And I sometimes think about where we're at, and I think we cannot possibly go any lower. And our heart sinks. The story of King Asa should come as an encouragement. God can do remarkable things. You know, I was thinking this week, you study the history of England. You know that in England, in the 18th century, this was a terrible period in England. Morally, spiritually. England, technically a Protestant Christian nation. By the 18th century, things are bleak. What's the culture like in England? A bunch of drunks. Gin houses everywhere. Drunkenness, gambling, animal cruelty. The justice system is broken. Some people joked at the time that it wasn't really that funny, but the death penalty was being so abused that some people said, so many people are being hung that they joked they were going to run out of rope. And the jails were overcrowded. People were being worked to death in the cities. Poverty, grinding and inescapable, sexual sin rampant, the monarchy corrupt, the church stagnant and cold. In many ways, the moral, spiritual climate of 18th century England was not all that much different than what Canada is like today. And when England looked like it couldn't sink any deeper into the sin and the depravity, God did something remarkable. He raised up in his mercy men like George Whitefield and John Wesley and Charles Wesley, and he poured out upon England a time of revival and spiritual renewal. And many scholars think if that did not happen, that England would have experienced revolution. They would have gone the same way as France. And that it was the evangelical revival that staved off revolution. The churches of England, Scotland, and Wales spiritually refreshed. The moral debauchery of the 18th century giving way to the Victorian age. Most of us think about old England. We think of the Victorian age, Christian virtue becoming the societal norm. Imagine that. Brethren, God can do things that we don't expect. Never despair. Never, ever give up hope. Instead, we pray that God raises up reformers in the church and the state, and we ourselves work towards reformation in the ways that we can. Many of us in this room today, I don't know the future. We may not live to see the reformation in Canada. I may not live to see it with my own eyes. But it may indeed be the case that we are right now raising the generation that will push the Reformation forward and that will stem the tide of wickedness in this nation. And who knows, maybe there is a young Asa among us even today. God can transform wayward, wicked nations. God can replace godless tyrants with faithful reformers. And so allow the story of Asa to fill your heart with hope. It shows the power and the mercy of God. At the same time, the failures of Asa, the temporary nature of most historical periods of Reformation, remind us that even the best of kings are men with clay feet. And so while we give thanks for reforming men like Asa, and we pray that God will raise them up here in our own nation, we know as Christians that a better king is on the way. For a while, Asa was a relatively good king. But as we study through the rest of this book, we are going to see not a single king in Israel's history does not disappoint. Every one of them falls short. And the failure of these ancient kings prepares our hearts and it paves our way for the arrival of the only perfect king. And David spoke about him, Psalm 110. David says, "The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." Today is Palm Sunday. It's appropriate this morning that we turn our attention to the arrival of a king greater than David, greater than Solomon, greater than Asa. The arrival of King Jesus, his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Where King David failed, where King Solomon failed, where King Asa failed, King Jesus triumphs. He's the only perfect king that the world has ever known. His is the only perfect kingdom the world ever will know. And so here's some good news on Palm Sunday, that your perfect king has already come. And his eternal kingdom is already here. It is already broken in. And it is on the increase. As Isaiah the prophet tells us, of the increase of his government, there shall be no end. That's good news. And all those who welcome King Jesus and submit to his lordship and authority will live forever in his eternal kingdom. Kingdom being made manifest already, and a kingdom that will one day fill the entire earth. And so as we celebrate this weekend the arrival of King Jesus, we remember his death and his resurrection the week to come. Let's conclude our time in the Word this morning with these ancient words, the psalm, foretelling the king's entry on Palm Sunday. Psalm 24. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. Amen.